When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The official Brighton and Hove Albion podcast.
Welcome back to the podcast with me, Paul Haywood.
And me, Glenn Murray. This is part two of our conversation with the club's deputy chair and chief executive, Paul Barber. You can catch up with part one by scrolling back through the archive.
We had a fascinating chat in the last episode and we have more of the same for you now. Paul tells us about plans for a new fan zone at the Amex, a new stadium for the women's team, and we put to him your questions on all things Brighton and Hove Albion. Paul, let's look ahead now to the future for the club on the men's and women's side. First of all, the fan zone is actually a bigger thing than it sounds, isn't it? Because it's a big issue in football. You and I discussed Anfield and the way Anfield has very cleverly created this area where fans turn up 4 hours before the game. They listen to bands, they eat good food, they drink, they see old friends. That's the kind of vision you have in mind for the Amex, isn't it?
Definitely. First of all, I think given where we are and some of the constraints we have around transport, it's a really essential part of our development, because hopefully if we can get people here earlier, keep them here later, we can elongate the pressure on the transport system, which will mean that people's journey here and journey home will be that much more pleasurable, hopefully, easier certainly. But in the meantime, it gives them an opportunity to expand their match day with us. And as you say, eat, drink, watch other games, see some music, hear some music, watch some bands, meet friends, meet family. And, you know, one of the other challenges of modern football stadium is that if you're in the West Stand and your mates are in the South Stand, you can't actually get round, you know, the building to meet them. So having a facility outside where in the better weather, you know, we hope that we'll be accommodating 2,000-3,000 people in and around the fan zone. And in the more inclement weather, you know, at least 1,000 inside the building. It's a significant investment for us and hopefully will be really enjoyable for the fans.
What's the timescale for that?
We hope to have it open by the early autumn. It, you know, in our ideal world, it would have been open in time for the Euros, but it's not going to be ready, unfortunately, in time for the Euros. There's been some extra work we've had to do under the ground because of cables that were already laid there for many years. So that's delayed us a little bit. So early autumn, that will be, you know, when we're looking to open. And of course, that would be just about in time, hopefully, to catch the best of the late summer, early autumn weather, but certainly in time for when the worst weather comes.
And a stadium for the women's team in Brighton?
That's definitely our plan. I mean, I think, you know, as good as Crawley have been to us and for us in getting our Women's Super League team up and established, we know it's not where our fans want us to play. We know it's not where our players want us to play. We know Crawley's a red stadium, we're a blue team. It just doesn't work for us in lots of ways. And also it's pressure on Crawley themselves. You know, they've got a football club and they play a good level of football and they want their pitch to be the best it can be. We add to that pressure on the pitch and vice versa. So in an ideal world, we want to build our own stadium for the women's team. There are lots and lots of differences between a stadium that's designed for men's football and for a predominantly male audience, not exclusively male, obviously, versus one that's designed for a women's football team and for a different audience. Our architects identified about 30 different things that would be different if you were to design a stadium for female athletes from the start. I mean, just a small example, if you look at the first team dressing room here at the Amex, I think there's two cubicles. Well, if you've got 20 female athletes at half time and maybe 10 or 12 female staff, that's a busy couple of cubicles in an 18-minute period. So practical things like that. And then, of course, out on the concourses, you know, we're geared up to sell thousands and thousands of pints of beer and thousands of big pies. The audience for a women's game is different. We don't sell as much beer. We don't sell as many pies. It's a different kind of food and drink offer that we need to look at. But our stadium here at the Amex isn't designed for that. So in an ideal world, and with Tony's backing and with the local authorities' support, if we can find the right plot of land to build a specific stadium for our women's team. We think that's the best option. And then at some stage in the future, when we've learned a lot about how women's football is consumed, if I can use that word, then we can start maybe making modifications to the Amex. And when the audience is big enough, then we'll be able to move both our first teams into the same stadium and then build the audiences on from there, which will be a great, great scenario.
And we would be the first club to do that in the world?
Certainly in the UK. I think there's one club in the US now that claims to have built a specific stadium for its women's team. But certainly the first in the UK, first in Europe, which will be amazing. And again, I think it's about building not only our brand as a football club, but also our attractiveness to players. You know, one of the reasons we attract the players we do now is because we've got world-class facilities both here and at Lancing. And we want the same to be true for the women's team. We've already got great training facilities for them at Lancing, but we also want a great base for them to play. And as good as Crawley has been for us in its own way, it is not what we want for the future of our women's team.
One of your old clubs, Paul, Spurs, is in trouble over ticket prices. What's your thinking on ticket prices for the next few seasons here?
Well, we've had to go up this year, partly because of the inflationary pressures that are on the club from so many different directions, but partly because we'd held those prices for as long as we could post-COVID. We recognised that the cost of living crisis was hurting a lot of people, particularly in the south of England. We recognised that a lot of people lost their jobs or had to change their jobs during COVID. But we want people to still fill the seats here. We want to make sure that we've got a full stadium and a lot of demand for the tickets that exist. So certainly the board is committed to try and keeping our ticket prices as reasonable as we can. We've already got the interest and fee-free season ticket payment plan, which helps people. We include at the moment the cost of travel, which I think further assists people. We've got the fan zone coming, which again will hopefully elongate and make the match day experience even better for people. So all round, we think that we're in a pretty good place given our position in the south of England, given that we've been in the top 10 in the Premier League for the last couple of seasons. We think we provide pretty good value for money and a good experience when people get here.
Moving on for that, Paul, I just want to ask how your role has changed over the years, especially with the increase of tech and data when it comes to transfers, bringing staff in around the place, business plans, etc.
Well, on the transfer front, you know, we are data driven, and you know, we also divide our resources as best we can. So I don't tend to get too much involved these days, unlike the old days of players coming in. I tend to be used more for players going out. So
is that why it's got better?
probably for sure. You mean the sales? But no, I think you know, we've grown as a club. We've added to our resources, we've added to our expertise, and actually there are times when it makes absolute sense for a small team to be focused on the players coming in, you know, using the data, find the players, negotiate with the club, negotiate with the player, the agent, bring them in, player care team takes over, make sure they're settled as quickly as possible, hands a player over to the coaches ready for training and development.
Do you step into that at sort of when it comes to brokering the deal at
if
any
needed
stage?
And you know, very often these days I'm not needed anything like I was, you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago, because we've got an established team now that is sophisticated to do that work. If there's a relationship, if I know the club, if I know the player, if I know the agent, then occasionally that I'll get involved in that. But more often than not, I'm looking on the players going out, because that's where we've got to maximise what we've done. First of all, maximise the initial recruitment from a part of the world that maybe other clubs weren't looking in, maximise the work that the development team have done in maybe pushing that player to different loans, the coaching team have done when they've come back here to make them a first team player. And then just the chairman's overall investment in that player holistically, right from the moment we bought them in to the moment we're ready to sell. And then it's my job to try and maximise the value. And in the case of Caicedo, that was obviously a lot of money. Cucurella, a lot of money. Trossard and so on. But that tends to be how we divide our resources here. And we've become, you know, pretty good at making sure that we use each other's strengths to get the best result for the club.
Do you think any other club has any chance of matching your data analysis model? Because at the moment they're all green, aren't
they? Well, I can think of a couple.
Really? Well,
they're chasing, just from people that have left.
Well, they're chasing hard, but you know, people are one part of the process. The data itself is the most important part of the process, and how we interpret it and how we use it is something that we've been building skill in and experience in over many, many years now. So, you know, we always talk about, you know, losing people as part of that process is never great. That, you know, losing good people is not what you want, but none of those people are irreplaceable. The data would be.
Yeah.
And, you know, that data is ours. It's something that is ours alone, and our interpretation of that data is also critical in that process. So from that point of view, you know, the longer it goes on, the more we use it, the more we're familiar with it, the more accurate our work with it is. Hopefully that will make our recruitment solid for very many years to come.
So in layman's terms, you could leave, but you couldn't take that machine with you, could you? The machine goes on.
Correct.
Is that a worry when people have been inside the football club and have a in-depth understanding of that it can be replicated elsewhere?
Yeah, they can understand how we work, but they haven't got the data to take away to work with.
And is that unique to Tony?
That's unique to Tony. That's unique. And from that point of view, that gives us that edge that we think we can maintain. That's not to say other clubs are not building their own data sets. That's not to say other clubs are not using data, because they all are now, particularly at the top level, not just in this country, but overseas as well. But it means that, you know, from our point of view, we're not as vulnerable to losing recruitment staff as maybe some of our fans think we are, or the media from time to time think we are. But as I say, that's not to say we want to lose good people, because we don't. But we're certainly comfortable in making sure that we've got people in-house to replace them, and our work with the data carries on.
The global profile of the club has risen enormously. Is there still more potential in that?
Oh, I think huge potential. I mean, we still don't quite dominate the south of England, Paul. You know, we've got so much work to do in this country, let alone overseas. So from my point of view, last summer going to the US was a really interesting test of how much people had kind of got to know about Brighton. Would they come and watch us in the US? And they did, as you know, in three sold out stadiums. This summer, we're hoping to go to the Far East. It's quite complicated because there's various other things going on in that part of the world this summer involving other clubs. But we're hoping to go there. That will be another test. Obviously, while we've got Carew with us, it would be fantastic to go to Japan. And then at some point, you know, in the future, to go back to the US. You know, we've got two very big sponsors whose businesses are headquartered in the United States. So it's always good to go back. For American Express and Nike particularly. So, you know, I think there's so much more that we can do, and we're seeing more and more sales of our merchandise to overseas markets. We're seeing more and more people from different parts of the world hitting our website, using our social media. There's plenty more I think we can do.
When we talked about the fan zone, the way that you described it to me, it felt very NFL-y, where people turn up for long periods and spend a long time together before the game. One thing that really struck me when we were over in the States last summer on the pre-season tournament was how much merchandise American sports fans wear. Do you ever think that you can get English people wearing so much?
Well, it's funny. When I worked in North America, there were so many things that I loved about the way that they presented their sport and the way the fans consumed their sport. But I also was aware that the sport itself was only one part of their day. I think in the UK it's different. I think although increasingly we're seeing fans buy more merchandise and spend more time at the stadium, in and around the stadium, fundamentally it's still the sport that's the most important thing. The 90 minutes in our case, or 100 minutes as it is now, is still the most important thing for football fans in England and in Europe. So it is different, but I do think, you know, we are seeing more and more people willing to spend money on things with our badge on, which is great. But I think also fundamentally they also want to spend more time with their friends and family around the game, talking about it, enjoying it, the excitement building up, you know, other things going on, whether it's food, drink, music, entertainment. And so, yeah, we think the fan zone is a nice blend of where they've done well in North America particularly, but what we do really well here, which is the match itself.
The official Brighton and Hove Albion podcast.
Another big story at the moment, Paul, is regulation and regulators. Just in case anybody doesn't know, the Football Governance Bill recommended the appointment of a regulator, and the government, this government, appears to be pressing ahead with that. The Premier League is pushing back against it, and writing in the Times, Richard Masters, the chief executive, said, "Empires rise and fall, and while I am confident about the league's immediate future, it would be a mistake to be complacent about our place as the world's most popular league." Now, Brighton doesn't particularly need external oversight for all the reasons we talked about, but does the Premier League and does football?
Well, I think, first of all, we need to put it into context that there's this sort of impression sometimes that we don't already support the pyramid. I mean, over 3 years, I think we donate around £1.6 billion every 3 years to the rest of football, just from the Premier League alone. So I think that's important to get out there. I think the other thing we need to recognise is there's nearly 100,000 jobs, all told, that are sustained by the Premier League, and that's £4 billion in tax that goes to the government already. So the suggestion that the Premier League isn't already doing a lot is wrong, and fundamentally wrong. We know from our own experience 26, 27 years ago that football clubs at the other end of the pyramid are far more vulnerable. They're far more susceptible to downturns in form and fortune, bad owners, difficult situations with stadiums. We've been there. We know what that's like. So we're the last club that would say we don't want the rest of football to feel and be more sustainable. Of course we do. But we've got to find a formula that's fair for everyone. You know, in the Championship, in the league immediately below us, we've got clubs with owners wealthier than ours who will use the money to replace us if they can. And that's an uncomfortable situation for any Premier League club, particularly one like ours that's been in the league for seven seasons. We've worked really hard to get here. We're working even harder to stay here. And whilst we're very happy to contribute to a more sustainable football pyramid, it's got to be fair for everyone. If we were talking about the money, extra money being used on facilities, on infrastructure, to make those clubs more sustainable by building out their commercial teams and so on, I think we would be more comfortable. But if we're talking about simply putting more money into salaries for players and making those clubs' salary bills even higher, that's not making them more sustainable. That is simply racing further and further to a situation where perhaps in the future, if we don't have the revenues that we've now got and can't pay as much money, you could argue it's making those clubs even more unsustainable or less sustainable. So for us, it's about making sure that this is a fair and balanced process, and that any legislation that is being pushed through isn't rushed, that it's proportionate, that it's sustainable in itself. We would be the only top league in world football to be subject to a regulator. Given that we're probably the most successful top league in world football, that seems slightly incongruous to all of us. But, as I said, we're very committed to making sure the pyramid is as sustainable as possible.
But it's still possible, isn't it, for a Premier League club to be taken over by a speculator and crashed, you know, misused, in other words. So clubs do need protection, don't they, from predatorial owners, potential predatorial owners?
Yeah, we again, I think the owners and directors tests has been always been a difficult issue for football authorities, because ultimately the law of the land will always supersede, you know, regulations in football. So certainly oversight to create a more sustainable ownership model, you know, certainly is something we're open-minded to. I think also we've just got to make sure that, again, we're not going to see a regulator come in and damage what we've already got or make it even harder for us to be successful. Because going back to the first point I made, £1.6 billion already flows down. If we start to chip away at that or damage that or damage the success that revenue comes from, then actually we're taking us further away from football being sustainable, not closer. And I think that's potentially a danger. It's an unforeseen potential consequence. But of course, we're in a period now where we just don't know what the real implications for football might be.
Glenn, you had some views on that, didn't you?
I just think that comparing now to back in the day, I think football's self-regulated much better. I think when it comes to the power managers got throughout a football club, agents, the owners and directors test, I think obviously with the funds involved in football, you're always going to attract some bad people along the line. But that has always been the case, and I think it's much harder for those types to get involved now in the game.
Yeah, I think also we need to go back to COVID. We lost £2 billion as a Premier League during COVID, but no EFL club went under during that period, and that was probably the worst period for football. So the Premier League in itself at that time contributed to ensuring that no other club in the country, you know, could go under during that period. It played a part then. But as I said before, you know, it's difficult to see a time when clubs are not going to chase promotion. They're not going to chase progression. And that could lead to owners overreaching and overstretching. No amount of money from the Premier League in those situations is going to make a difference. You know, that comes down to management and management decisions that we've all had to make. So it's about balance. And, you know, for us, the pyramid is really special. We've been at every level in the pyramid. We know what it's like. I think we became the 21st club since the Premier League was conceived to make it all the way through the pyramid into European football. You know, the dream is still alive, and it's important that we play our part in keeping that dream alive for fans of clubs currently in League Two. Of course it is, but we've got to make sure that we don't damage clubs that are currently helping to fund those clubs. It's just about striking that balance, and it feels uncomfortable that government feel that they need to intervene to make that happen. Football hasn't helped itself in the last couple of years with some of the things that have happened. We know that. European Super League hasn't helped. You know, one or two clubs getting into financial difficulties hasn't helped. Some of the narrative around the game hasn't helped. But we've got to be careful that we don't damage the golden goose that is currently helping to fund the whole of football. We've got to make sure that we protect that as well.
Yeah, I think when you mentioned there, ultimately we are involved in an emotional sport, and even the most measured men just want to stretch themselves a little bit further to get into a playoffs, to get promoted, and that is natural, and that will always be the case. And I think you can regulate it, but you can't control clubs' decisions internally.
My big problem is with nation states owning football clubs. No football club can hope to compete with a Gulf state, a petro state, the wealth of a petro state. But then I suppose you could argue that the sustainability rules are in place to stop that position being abused in part. It works to a degree, doesn't it? So
it does to a degree, and you know, we're still looking now at more financial rules. And you know, one of the things that we, you know, again, we've been criticised for not reaching an agreement with the EFL sooner. But I think it was important to all Premier League clubs that we also understood what our own financial rules were going to be before we start giving, you know, tens of millions, hundreds of millions more pounds away. We needed to understand what rules were going to be governing our league and our spending and how we would compete and ensure that we could stay competitive. So that takes time. And you know, I think someone once said, and I think Richard said it in his article yesterday or today, that, you know, rush legislation is often bad legislation. You know, we've got to make sure that we're not rushed into doing something that isn't actually going to achieve what the government would like it to. And that it, you know, doesn't damage what's already there that is doing very well. So that balance is really important going forward.
The law of unintended consequences. Well, it's a democracy, so we ought to turn now to questions from some fans. What is your favourite part about the club?
I think the culture and the fact that we've got no ceiling to what we can achieve.
What is the most time-consuming aspect of your job?
That's a really good question. I suppose all of the different stakeholder management. So speaking to fans, media, sponsors, government, local authorities, football authorities, that's these days where I spend most of my time. And it's good time spent, but it is a lot of time spent.
What has been your favourite game of the season so far and why?
There will be several. I think pretty much any of the European games that we won would be so memorable. You know, they were just special occasions, home and away. So I would put all of them in the same basket.
Marseille away for me. Where does the club aim to be in 10 years?
I think we would certainly want to be still competing in the top half of the Premier League as a minimum, regularly playing in European competition, and hopefully have added some substantial silverware to our cabinet.
This is a very politely phrased question. How active does the club plan to be this summer? Otherwise known as, how much will you spend?
We will always look to strengthen in every transfer window. I mean, as always, we would never give away targets or budgets, but certainly we always like to strengthen from position of strength, and I think we are strong. We know if we've got all of our players back, we've got a strong squad already. So to improve that is going to take some doing.
So there will be approaches for players in the summer, Paul, but it's by no means a given that they're going to leave or that you're going to let them leave. So how do you go about keeping them here?
Well, we start from the point of view of we don't need to sell or want to sell any of the players that we've got. So that's a great position. Financially, we certainly don't need to. In terms of what Roberto wants to do and what we want to do, we don't need to. There's always going to be interest in players that have done well when the club's done well. And we'll always deal with those requests in our time, in our way. And you know, the great position that we've always taken is that we'll sell when we're ready and it's right for the player, not one or the other. And that will be our philosophy going forward as well.
Well, I think this has been quite a hot topic in the media of recent, but what is the biggest challenge you're facing at the club right now?
I think just the overall competitiveness of the league. You know, we've got clubs like Aston Villa that were behind us last season that have invested hugely and have really done well this season. You've got other bigger clubs, Chelsea being a good example, again, were behind us last season, that are pushing really hard to be ahead of us this season. So we've always said that to stand still in the Premier League is effectively to go backwards. You know, our biggest challenge is to remain competitive and to get better every year.
So just on that very quickly, so positions 6 to 10 are getting tougher, aren't they?
Really tough. If you look at the points differential between those places, bearing in mind that it's not just about the competition that you could go into by finishing at the top end of that group, but the value. You know, it's £2 million a place in the Premier League. So, you know, a split to 6th to 10th, you're looking at sort of an £8 million gap in your revenues if you slide from 6th to 10th on the last day. Conversely, if you can get yourself from 10th to 6th on the last day, it's a very, very good thing for the club's finances.
How, as a club, can we improve on the women's side?
I think getting our purpose-built stadium would make a huge difference. I think one for the players, therefore performances on the pitch, I think would naturally improve. And secondly, I think it would help us to increase the size of the audience for our women's team, which we're really keen to do.
Last one, what's been your most rewarding experience since you joined the football club?
I would say two things, Glenn. Getting promoted to the Premier League, which you were a big part of, and getting into European football. Those two things, absolutely huge. And if I put them in the context of being lucky enough to be at a World Cup quarterfinal with England, cup finals with Tottenham, and great experiences in Vancouver in Major League Soccer, they would literally be all of those.
I mean, the first one was an aim when you joined the club, but the second one, a dream?
Absolute dream. And I think, again, talking as I have over the years to so many Brighton fans, if you'd have said to Brighton fans when I joined the club, let alone in the 10 years or 20 years before that, that we would be playing Ajax, Marseille, AEK Athens, Roma in the Europa League in 2023, 24, they would have just shaken their head and laughed. And it's actually happened. And, you know, it could well happen again in the future. And we're going to work very hard to make sure it does.
So all we need to do now is extend this podcast's contract until 2030 as well. So have you got the paperwork?
Yeah, it's not in my gift, Paul, unfortunately.
We'll get reviewed over
the far more important people than me that make those decisions.
Paul, thanks very much for joining us. That was a really, really interesting survey of the past, the present and the future.
No problem. It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul.
Cheers, Glenn.
Big thanks to Paul again for his time. Thoroughly enjoyed that, Paul. Really insightful, and he always speaks so well.
Yeah, it's good to get that voice, that clarity from the top of the club, isn't it? And we covered so much ground. I hope listeners will feel that all the issues have been addressed. And one of the things I took away from it is just how competitive it is in that part of the table where Brighton are, how hard it is to stay there, how hard it is to progress. But again, all the building blocks are there, aren't they?
They are indeed, and when he mentioned about that final day swing and what it could mean for the club, it is quite incredible, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's going to be an interesting summer as well, and I think it's significant that he said that clubs may come for Brighton players, but it doesn't necessarily mean they're going to get them.
Yeah, I mean, he touched on that, didn't he, about that cycle of bringing in and being a stepping stone club, but we're becoming more than that now, and that is the transition we see ourselves in at the moment.
Thanks for listening to the official Brighton and Hove Albion podcast. Hit subscribe if you want our next episode delivered directly to your device.
If you're craving more Albion content, check out the latest episode of Inside Albion, your best way to see behind the scenes, out now on the official club YouTube.
The official Brighton and Hove Albion podcast. Social Podcast Network.